We're going to be in Esther chapter 3 is where we're going to be. Are we ready? We can turn it on, I think. Okay. And we've been studying the book of Esther. And this occurred at a time when many of the Jews were going back to the Holy Land of Jerusalem to rebuild the temple in the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. And right in the midst of all this, chronologically, the book of Esther occurs. And as we see, it is back in Persia. And so there are some occurrences happening back in the land of Persia under King Ahasuerus. And we're reading in the first chapter, we're having a bunch of characters introduced to us as God's unfolding this particular story to us. And chapter 1 basically was introduced to us. The king in Persia at the time was Ahasuerus the king. And in chapter 2 was introduced to us Esther the queen. And so we've been so far through the story. And remember, the story was Ahasuerus' wife became disobedient, and they decided to have a beauty contest to find another woman to be queen. And this Jewish girl, whose real name was Hadassah, but her Persian name was Esther, she was part of the beauty pageant contest, and she was had a very meek and a humble spirit, as opposed to all the other girls who had like an outward beauty but no inward beauty. And the king actually took her to be his new bride. And so that was in the second chapter. Now, what we're going to see in this particular book is the fact that even though Esther and her uncle Mordecai are Jews living in Persia at the time, they were kind of disobedient Jews. Because had they been really obedient to the call of God, they would have left Persia and gone back to Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple, been part of the rebuilding with the other Jews. And what we're going to see in this particular book is that even when someone is out of the will of God, God's providence still takes care of them. This is part of the goodness of God. This is like another portrait would be way, way back when they left the land of the Egypt at the time of the Exodus, and they were in the wilderness. And even though many of the Jews that were in the wilderness during that 40-year period on the way to the promised land got, if you will, out of the will of God, they were disobedient, they murmured, they complained, God still provided for them for 40 years manna in the wilderness. I mean, he didn't give up on them despite the fact they had kind of given up on him. They weren't getting out of God what they wanted out of him. And so this is a story that we're going to find throughout the scriptures, is God still takes care of his people even when they're not being obedient and doing what they're supposed to be. And so we're sad. It's sad to see that in terms of the people, but it's good to see it in terms of the goodness of God. Now, in the third chapter, a new character is going to be introduced to us tonight. And we'll read and comment as we go along. Here's the third chapter. This is a kind of a sad scene. It says, verse 1, chapter 3, after these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman. This is the bad character that's going to be introduced, Haman, the son of Hamaditha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate, they bowed and they reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. And we're going to see the introduction of a character in here, that this man, this Haman, is, it tells us he's an Agagite. Agagite. So we'd have to go back into the books of Chronicles and Kings and Samuel to find out. Actually, Samuel would be the best place we would find out about this man. And it was at the time when Saul was the first king of the nation, and God told Samuel to tell Saul to go out and to battle with the Amalekites. And let me see if I can find the chapter where he did that again. I'm just pulling it out here. I'll find it somewhere. And see. I should have gone back and put it in my notes, but I had a bad back today. I wasn't doing all that well. Okay, it would be chapter 15, 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. And Samuel tells Saul in verse 1, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over Israel. Now therefore hearken to the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he, Amalek, had laid in wait for him, by the way, when he came from Egypt. Now go in and smite Amalekite and Amaleks and destroy them utterly." And so this is a God telling him to go and to battle with the Amalekites. And it turns out that we're going to find out verse 8 that Agag is the king of the Amalekites. Now, so Agag, this man, Haman, was an Agagite. So he is a descendant of King Agag. And what actually happened there was Saul, he was supposed to destroy the Amalekites, and he decided to spare King Agag. And Agag lived, and then he had children, and his children lived, and his descendants lived. And now here we are centuries later, I don't know how many centuries later, it might be 5 centuries or so later, and Agag's kids are still alive, and now this man Haman, who's an Agagite, which means he's an Amalekite, is living amongst the Persians, and here he is being promoted. And all God is showing us here is the reality that there's an ongoing battle in the world of good versus evil. And there are those on the side of good. That would be when Moses said, who's on the Lord's side? Because Jesus said there is one good, that is God. And so if you're on the Lord's side, then you're on good, the side of good. But if you're on the other side, you're on the side of evil. And as Samuel had said to Saul, I remember what Amalek did. And when you go all the way back and you read in the time of the Exodus in chapter 17, as the people were coming across the wilderness, it says in the 17th chapter, then came Amalek and fought with Israel. And so they were out, they were away from their homes, they were on foot, they had just the, at that point, whatever little food they had at that time, and they were wandering, and they seemed to be take advantage of, like people on a caravan. And Amalek came and fought with them. And of course, Moses went up and prayed, and Aaron prayed, and Hur prayed, and out went Joshua and fought, and they were able to win that first battle against the Amalekites. And the Lord said in the end of that chapter, the Lord has sworn, this is Exodus 17, verse 16, the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And, of course, going back in the time of the Old Testament, he's saying there's a particular group of people, they love the evil and they hate the good. And they're against what God is for. And God is going to fight with them. When they pick a fight, God's going to fight back with them. And how long will this go on? Generation after generation after generation. That's a physical truth. The spiritual truth is that Amalek, and you'd have to go back and look at, I believe it's Genesis chapter 36. Amalek is a descendant of a mixed marriage between Esau and Ishmael. And he represents, if you will, the flesh and a wrong spirit. And so generation after generation, the children of God are going to be fighting the battle against the flesh and the wrong spirit. And that's just part of the enemies that we have. So the portraits are being given here. And so getting back to the book of Esther, we see this same old battle that's going on, that went on in the past. It goes on today. It will go on until the Lord Jesus Christ himself comes back with a rod of iron and subdues the Amalekites and the Agagites and all those people that are the rebels, and he finally sets up the world that will come wherein is peace and righteousness. But until that time, this is the battle. And here's the battle going on back here in the land of Persia, and there's some of God's people living amongst the Medo-Persians. Today God's people are living, whatever community they're living in, they have some people to fight, and there's going to be some Hamans out there. There's going to be some people in position of leadership that's going to be against the people of God. And that's what we're seeing here. As a matter of fact, Paul warned us that there would be spiritual wickedness in high places. And he says that in the book of Ephesians. That's chapter 6. That's verse 12. We're going to wrestle against these spiritual Hamans, and those people are going to be put in positions of rulership. And that's why we'll see things like this. And so here it is going on back in historical times. So what happens is the king, this, as we learned in chapter 1, this foolish king, Ahasuerus, is promoting people that he ought not to promote. And so often that goes on in just about every country. Somehow the wrong people get promoted to positions of leadership. It's very rare that good people are promoted. Now, God one day will promote them. It says promotion comes from the north, and one day God will lift them up. But right now, we're down in the trenches fighting, and here the battle's about to go on. So, he gets promoted. Verse 2, people are told to reverence him. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, sir. Yes, Governor. Yes, Senator. All this proper decorum, and everyone's doing it. But end of verse 2, but Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Mordecai, he might not have been obedient enough to go back and build the temple, but he had enough of an understanding you're not to bow down to men. And so he realized, I was trained as a Jewish boy that the only one that's worthy of worship is God, and men are not worthy of my worship, and I will not bow down to a man. And so here's one good thing that he's doing, and I hope that God's children have learned that. We're not to bow down to men. We're to honor them, but not to bow down to them. And he wouldn't do that. Now, what happens, we learn in verse 3, is then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, you know, the local bureaucrats in the area working around the king, the government workers, said to Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Again, why is he doing that? Because he has read the Bible. For example, when this occurred, this was 400 years after Solomon had done his writing about kings. And for example, if you were to go to the book of, let's say, Proverbs, chapter 12, and some of the admonitions that were given to this Mordecai. Again, partial obedience. I know God would like full obedience, but at least getting some steps in the right direction is a good thing to learn. And Proverbs chapter 12, and it says in verse 8, we're going to see as we go through this chapter that this Mordecai, this Haman, is a man who's contrary to God's will. He's foolish in his heart. Proverbs 12:8, a man shall be commended according to his wisdom. Now, this is when a good king is in leadership, like Solomon. But he that is of a perverse heart shall be despised. And so, when I see a man that has the wisdom of God, I commend that man. When I see someone with a perverse heart like Haman, ye that love the Lord, hate evil. We're told to love the good and hate the evil. We're to have a righteous type of a hatred and to hate those things that are wrong. This is a man not worthy of our reverence or respect. Go to Proverbs 17. Look at verse 15. Why don't you bow, they say to Mordecai. Why aren't you bowing down to Haman? He says, well, it says in the book of Proverbs, chapter 17, verse 15, he that justifieth the wicked and he that condemneth the just, even they both are abomination to the Lord. If I was to justify this man and give him honor and reverence that he's not worthy of, that would be an abomination in God's sight. It's a foolish thing for me to say something good of a man that's contrary to the way and the will of God, that he's not worthy of respect. He's worthy of being revealed for what he is. The truth needs to be spoken. And so these are some of the things that had influenced Mordecai. There's other verses in there that we could find. For example, go to Proverbs 24:24. Proverbs 24:24. He that saith unto the wicked, oh, thou art righteous, him shall the people curse. Nations shall abhor him, but to them that rebuke him shall be delight, and a good blessing shall come upon them. And maybe not right now, but when the Lord comes back and starts to give an account and to his servants as to how he's been watching them, he's going to, and the rewards that he's going to give are eternal. And I don't want to be known as someone that has told a wicked man, thou art righteous. The world may do it, but we won't. And Mordecai didn't. So, verse 4. Back to Esther, where we are in the chapter. So, now it came to pass, when they, these are the other king's servants, the other bureaucrats, spake to him daily, and he hearkened not to them. This is another good thing that he did. He didn't give in to peer pressure. He didn't give in to the fear of man. Gee, he would have been a blessing if he only go back and help rebuild the temple. But at least he's doing one thing well. And again, one of the things God is showing is that in his children, they have some strong points, they have some weak points. They have some things they do well, they have some things they do not so well. And God observes the things they do well. And he moves in to protect. And so Mordecai is going to get some protection here because he's doing the right thing. Now it came to pass, they spake them daily, verse 4. He hearkened not to them. So what did they do? Then they told Haman. Then they went and tattled like a bunch of little girls and ran over and squealed. And then they went to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. What does that mean? For he had told them he was a Jew. Somewhere along the line, when they pressured him daily, he said, one of the reasons I don't bow down is I'm a Hebrew. I'm a Jew. I'm an Israelite. I'm one, my faith is of the Lord Jehovah. And I can't bow down to a man because there's only one God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. That's all I can bow down to. And so he did that, and now it came out. Now remember, in chapter 1 and 2, he had told them, don't tell anybody we're Jews. Don't tell anybody we're Jews. But finally, he had to reveal who he was. By the way, I'm glad that he did. It's good when one is understood right off the bat that, hey, I'm a born-again Christian. I'm not hiding till the last minute until the pressure comes my way. It should be known, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. And it should have been known. Now it's come out. Verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then Haman was full of wrath. This Haman is not a man who's governed by principles of conscience. This is a man who seared his conscience. This is a man, he's an Amalekite. Someone's going to have perpetual war with the people of God, and he's got the wrath of man in him, which worketh not the righteousness of God. He's got envy and anger inside of him to the full. He's like a boiling pot ready to go over, and he was full of wrath. And verse 6, he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Somebody said, well, if this guy's really, you know, dissing you and disrespecting you, why don't you just go put him in his place and beat him up? And he said, that would not be sufficient to me. I mean, my judgment is not going to be equal and just. It's going to, my wrath is so big it's going to fall over. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. It would be too little for me just to deal with Mordecai and his family together. I'm going to kill all the Jews. And that's the hatred. Haman is full of the spirit of the Antichrist. He's full of the devil. The devil's desire is to destroy God's people. He has a hatred for God's people. Peter would write, be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary, that's the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. Who we'd like to devour? Anyone that stands for the Lord. Anyone that gives glory and honor to God, anyone that speaks the truth in righteousness and in love, that's someone he wants to take care of. And so Haman's got that spirit to him. Now, how's he going to do this? Well, we're going to kill all the Jews. Verse 7. So in the first month, that's the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. By the way, it said after these things did Ahasuerus promote Haman. If you went back into the beginning of this thing, I'm trying to remember, it talked about, it was in, I believe, the third year of Ahasuerus. Yeah, verse 3 of chapter 1. So now we're up to the 12th year of Ahasuerus. So chronologically, we've moved quite a ways through this book. I remember chapter 1 occurred, and then there was a three-year break between chapter 1 and chapter 2. So you go from, let's say, the third year to the sixth year, because they had the failed campaign against the Greeks in the battle. And now they went through a two-year process of, let's say, finding Esther to be the queen. And so now we're up to the 8th year of Ahasuerus. Now we're looking about 4 years after Esther had been made queen. This is when Haman gets promoted. So it's taken some time for this man, this Haman, to work his way up into the powers of position in the government. One thing you're going to find about the devil, he doesn't quit. He's got a long time horizon for this battle, and he's going to keep steady at his work. You know, it's a funny thing. You think you get a victory, whether it's in the spiritual realm or in the social realm, and no sooner a week later, the enemy comes right back. This battle is going to rage on for a long, long time. And so here we are. It's still going on, and now there are, it says, verse 7, cast pur. That's the lot before Haman from day to day, from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. So one of the things, I guess, that Haman was running was the government lottery. And I guess nothing's changed. We have government lotteries today. That's a wicked and an evil way to manage the funds that God has given a nation. Is casting lotteries. One of the reasons you got to understand that is the reason that lotteries are bad is lotteries are gambling, and what makes gambling bad is this. You say, wait a second, I got two consenting adults. Two consenting adults, they come to a table and they agree to put their money down, they put their ante up, and they play the game, and they both agree. Whoever wins gets to walk away, and they both agree to it. And a lottery is like a super system where everybody's putting their money in, and one or two winners is going to walk away. You say, that's okay, because everyone's in it by way of consent. But the Lord would look at it this way. This is how the Lord would look at it. Jesus was teaching one day on the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, it says, thou shalt not kill. But if thou was angry enough with thy brother, and you have anger, that without a cause, that's considered a sin in God's sight. So let's take a look at this. Let's take a look at two men. They got angry with each other, and they decide to settle it by having a duel. And so they both agree to take a pistol and to go 10 paces and to turn and face each other and to shoot. And they both agreed of their own consent. And then the duel happens, and one guy wins and one guy dies. In God's eyes, there were two murderers, not just one. Because even though the one guy that died, had he been the better shot, he would have won. Both of them had murder in their heart. And so God says they both broken that commandment, that sixth commandment of mine, thou shalt not kill. So let's say I got a lottery, and I have a couple of people throwing their money on a table. And they both gamble and they roll the dice or whatever they do, and one walks away a winner and the other guy goes, it's okay, man, I gambled and I lost this time. You know what? God says, I've got two thieves. You've both broken the eighth commandment. Because you were willing to take someone else's money without labor. And thou shalt labor in order that thou should eat. If a man does not work, he should not eat. God does not believe in gambling. God does not believe in theft. It's a form of theft. And so here they are running a public lottery. It's just showing you the way of lost people are going to set their government contrary to the laws of God. This is what the Apostle Paul referred to in the book of Thessalonians as the mystery of iniquity. The mystery of iniquity is that the government will frame laws contrary to God's Ten Commandments and you won't even be aware of it. Another one would be called taxation. That's another way of stealing from people, stealing the labor from people. So here they are, lotteries, taxation, this type of thing. They're doing this and they're throwing the lottery, and Haman's in charge of the lottery. He would roll the daily dice, and then they would have the announcement on the evening news as to who won the numbers that day, and that's what they were doing. And so Haman is a superstitious man that's willing to go by chance rather than go by the way of God. Verse 8, and Haman said to King Ahasuerus, you know, there's a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the people in all the provinces of the kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. So the first thing that we're going to see here is, here's the enemy of God's people. Now in his heart is a desire to destroy them, because it said a few verses earlier that he sought to destroy all the Jews. Now, he didn't have the power and the ability to do that, but the king did. He wanted to enact government law and get the power of the government to do his bidding. So he's got to convince the king, I want to kill these people. So the first thing, before I actually go into destroying them and doing the work and giving them the bad treatment I want to give them, the first thing I have to do is got to give them a bad reputation and a bad name. So I have to lie about the people of God. Well, it is true they are diverse. Whenever the devil lies, he's got a kernel of truth in there. They were diverse from the other people. But to say they don't keep the king's law, I didn't know of anything about Mordecai being unlawful. Matter of fact, from what I had read, he was a good servant, a civil servant, back in the second chapter. He did just fine. As a matter of fact, when he found out something that was unlawful, he related all the way to the king so that act could be stopped. So the point is, when the enemy begins, before he mistreats God's people, first thing he's got to do is ruin their reputation, ruin their name, ruin their testimony, and lie about them. He begins with lie before he gets to the point of murder. And so this is the common tactic that he's going to use all through the ages. You're going to have people, before they do something harmful to you, first they're going to speak ill of you. Before they hurt you physically, they're going to hurt your reputation. And so that's what he does. Now, what am I going to do? Okay, so, you know, these are the kind of people, I mean, they're so diverse, they don't even play the lottery with us. I've never had any of these people come play the lottery with us. Well, that's good. They shouldn't play the lottery. But anyways, so verse 9, you know, if it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. Really? That's the punishment for not playing the lottery? That's the punishment for being different? And here what you're going to see is the pattern throughout the scripture is the devil will tolerate diversity of error, but he will not tolerate anyone who's diverse with the truth about God. You want to have a religion here that's false? Go ahead, be my guest. You want to have another form of philosophy here that's false? Go ahead, be my guest. You want to live this way that's false or erroneous? Be my guest. I'll tolerate all this diversity, but when the truth comes, when there are people of God, that's the one thing I no longer tolerate. That's the one aspect of diversity I will not have in my presence. Let's destroy them. And that's what he wants to do. Now, how's he going to do it? Well, Haman, apparently, because of his royal descendancy and the inheritance he had some money. And he said in verse 9, middle, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. I've got a successful business. I've got a good inheritance. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Let me make a donation to your campaign so that you'll do what I'd like you to do. This is a significant donation. 10,000 talents of silver would be about $40 million today. That's a significant, that's a George Soros kind of a contribution. Not many politicians are going to turn that down, particularly if you consider that King Ahasuerus, it's chapter 3, verse 1, after these things, he just lost the Greek campaign. The public treasuries were a little down. They were running a little bit of a deficit. They could use an infusion of cash. And so he makes the offer. And verse 10, and the king took his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. And the king said to Haman, the silver is given to thee. In other words, you made that big deposit into my treasury of 10,000 talents of silver. We're going to take a little bit out, maybe 1,000, to give you enough to send out some troops to do that. Sure, the king got a little bit of vigorous in the deal there and kept a little for himself. But we're going to give you thee and to the people also to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. I mean, I'm going to let you have a little bit of that money back, and I'm going to give you the oversight of it, and you can be in charge of this entire project, since you paid for the right to do this. Verse 12, and then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, I lost that, and to every people after their language. And it was all written in the name of King Ahasuerus. It was written and sealed with the king's ring. And it wouldn't have been enough just to, I mean, you would think it'd be enough just to dispel the people, expel them from the country. I mean, after all, these are bad players here. We don't want them around. Why don't we just get them out? Why don't we just deport them? No, we're going to destroy them. It's not sufficient for the devil just to get rid of his enemies where they're out of his sight. He wants them dead. He's a murderer. He's a destroyer. And so this is what he writes, and it will not change. And verse 13, the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces. What did it say? To destroy, to kill, to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, to take the spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given to every province was published to all people, that they should be ready against that day. And so he takes this, and he uses it, and just like the enemies of God's people, no crime was laid to their charge in this writing. There was nothing that said what they had done wrong. There was no incident of there had been a trial against these people. It was just the command that went forth, destroy, kill, cause to perish. Who? The Jews. Well, which one? The males of fighting age? No, the young and the old. What you mean? The women and the children too. Kill them all. This is the desire of the enemy, the devil, to kill. This went on historically. This has gone on through the centuries. Go to Revelation chapter 17. This has gone on for the people of God, whether they be the Old Testament Jews of the nation of Israel or the New Testament Christians of the new birth in Jesus Christ. Revelation chapter 17. Verse 1, there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying, come hither. I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. There is a spirit of this great whore that we see is fed from the devil, and it's put into the ears of the kings of the earth. And the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And verse 6, and I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. You know, the amazing thing is the history books so cover it up that when we finally see the truth, we wonder with great admiration, go, I can't believe I never learned these things. And God says, I've laid this out for you. Here's the way they have behaved all through the centuries. Go, for example, to Psalm 15. Mordecai's training. You know, Haman, he would not submit to the law of God. Haman wanted to write his own laws for the king. But the strange thing about him is, in his superstition, he was willing to submit to the laws of chance. And you're going to find out he cast the lot, and we're going to see what happens at the end. It's funny about lost people the way they are. But Mordecai understood in the 15th Psalm, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly, that worketh righteousness, that speaketh the truth in his heart, he that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned. And his thought was, Haman is not worthy of respect. And he understood that. But Haman is of a very different cloth. And it's the hardest thing for us to understand, but there's only really, when it comes down to it, two types of hearts. Those hearts that are sensitive to the leading of the Spirit of God and the truth of God, and those hearts that are bent away in the wrong direction toward wickedness. And those that are bent in that direction will be drunken with the blood of the saints throughout the history of mankind. That's why the Lord must come back and do the judgment. And we'll see Babylon has fallen when the Lord comes back to take care of it. Now, going back to where we are in Esther. Esther, let me catch up with you. Chapter 3. So, he rolls the dice, and the dice comes out that it's going to be, verse 13, in one day will the judgment fall on the 13th day of the 12th month. And here you're going to see the hand of God in this. You've got to go to Proverbs. First, I want to show you the 18th chapter, and then we'll go to the 16th chapter. First, Proverbs 18. The same from Mordecai's standpoint, it was the same spirit of truth that provoked him to get Haman's anger. That's his obedience to the Lord, understanding a vile man should be condemned. I'm not going to honor him. That same Spirit of truth in him is going to also provide his salvation. And here's how the hand of God is invisibly working through this Psalm 18. Proverbs 18, I'm sorry, yeah, Proverbs 18. Because of the king was a fool, Ahasuerus, in that when Haman came to him, and made all these complaints about the Jews, the first thing a king should have done is, the king's throne is established by justice and righteousness. And verse 13, what the king should have done is, Proverbs 18:13, he that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame to him. The first thing the king should have done is said, well, I hear these complaints about the Jews, let me take some time to find out if this is true. Let me go through the kingdom. Let me hear if there are other complaints like that. And also let me give them a chance to testify and find out if any of these accusations you're making are true. But the foolishness of that king is he was so willing to abdicate responsibility. This is one of the greatest problems God sees, is people who aren't willing to labor for the truth. They're willing to abdicate and put things aside and let someone else do it. And what God wants every individual to do is to seek out the truth on their own. And here's how Ahasuerus fumbled in his handling of the throne. And, of course, God will remove the throne from him. Now, Haman himself, verse 18 of Proverbs 18, says, "The lot causeth contentions to cease and parteth between the mighty." Now Solomon is making an observation here in the book of Proverbs, given by the wisdom of God. And an observation, he says, you know, something that's strange about people is they won't listen to the instruction of God. You'll come to them and a fool will have more answers as to why he doesn't have to listen to what God says. But all of a sudden you roll dice and they'll go, "That's good." You flip a coin, you put your hands on a bat, and they'll walk away and go, "Oh, that's the way it is. Chance took care of it." They'll believe chance. They'll believe lot. They'll believe superstition. They'll believe luck, but they won't believe God. What a strange thing. You know, if two men are going to get in a fist fight or a gunfight over something, they say, "Okay, I got a way to settle it. We'll just flip a coin." "Okay." And they flip a coin, it comes up heads. "Okay, you won, I lost." And he walks away from it. That's bizarre. If truth is involved, I don't care what way that the coin flips. I don't care which way the dice roll. Truth is truth. But they have no connection to truth, and so they're willing to take the flip of a coin. Now, that same lot that Ahasuerus, knowing Haman's anger, Haman's anger was probably, "I want Mordecai dead yesterday." He finally gets into the ear of the king, and the ear says, "Here's my ring. You can write the posts. You can have it done." And his thought was, "I'd like to have it done immediately. You know what? Let me roll the dice and see how quickly it can get done." And all of a sudden he rolls the dice, and the dice don't come up. It was in January. It's not February. It's not March. I got to wait all the way to December. I got to wait 11 months. Why is that? Proverbs 16, verse 33. The same spirit of truth that provoked this entire incident is going to be the same spirit of truth that's going to protect the Jewish people. Psalm 16, verse 33. "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." God said, "Okay, you're going to be a foolish guy that believes luck. You don't realize my invisible hand behind the scenes. Up comes snake eyes. You got to wait till December. That's going to give my people plenty of time to get everything in place to thwart your plan." And so chapter 3, we see the introduction of the enemy of God's people. And and the last verse of the chapter is most interesting. So verse 14, the copy of the writing goes forth, and they got to wait till December because that's the way the dice rolled. And Haman's a man of, he's a stand-up guy. He'll follow the dice, but not God. Verse 15, and then the posts went out, and they were hastened by the king's commandment. And the decree was given in Shushan the palace, and it went out all of a sudden, a new decree, extra, read all about it. All Jews are going to be destroyed in December. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed. And the thing that we see here is the government workers, we'll call it the court of high opinion, just went out and had a drink and toasted the whole thing. A wicked law has just been written, and they're toasting and drinking and popping champagne corks over it. But the average person in the street is utterly perplexed. What is going on here? I mean, you think of our a nation. All of a sudden, in 1973, the High Court decrees that it's okay to murder babies in the womb. And they're all back there celebrating the great, mighty judgment that we just made to advance the nation forward. And when the decree came out across the United States, people were perplexed. "You mean you're going to kill babies? You mean you've legalized murder?" I mean, the nation was perplexed. What is this all about? The spiritual wickedness in high places. All of a sudden they came up, "We're going to have new sex education programs. We're going to teach 7-year-olds how to put condoms on a cucumber." And they're popping champagne corks. "Look how we've advanced the knowledge of the little kids." And the parents are perplexed. What's this all about? All of a sudden we've legalized the fact that transgenders can walk into a female shower or a female bathroom where there are little girls and they're popping corks, and look at the great progressive, how we've moved everything forward with this new law, and they're drinking, and the people are, what's this all about? And it shows when power is in the wrong hands of those who are under the influence of the enemy. How people are perplexed, going, this doesn't make any sense. This is contrary to common sense and reality. Yeah, no kidding. So next week, we're going to move on and see how, when the announcement does come forth, not only are the bystanders perplexed, but we're going to see the people of God are heartbroken over it, because their eyes are a little more opened. So that's all we have tonight. Yes, brother.